Hey everyone, welcome back to our series, Key Battles in the Revolutionary War. In the last episode, it ended on a high note. Well, high note if you're a sympathizer of the Patriots, a low note if you're a sympathizer of the Tories. We saw British General John Burgoyne fail to isolate New England from the American colonies. That was a plan to cut them off, isolate them, the hotbed of the revolution. It failed. Well, the plan, which leads into this current episode, was in 1777 that the colonies would be divided. Burgoyne would take his 10,000 men, and then 2,000 would travel down Lake Ontario and attack east through the Mohawk Valley toward Albany. Howe, who was working with Burgoyne, planned to join forces with him at Albany, but then Howe decided not to proceed with his march, and then he decided not to tell Burgoyne at all what was going on. So some miscommunication going on because Howe has something else in mind. So, James, what does General Howe have in mind?
Yeah, in fact, let me back up just a little bit more because the listeners, I'm not sure how long it's been since they listened to the episodes on Trenton and Princeton, but we're going to go back down and look at Washington versus Howe. And we last left Washington with a couple of really nifty victories. Nifty is probably a silly word for that, but I say nifty because they were not major crushing blows against the British. In fact, they were primarily against the Hessians, although somewhat against the British too, but they were morale builders. Washington had been driven out of New York City by Howe, and he had had to retreat across New Jersey and even into Pennsylvania. And then he did a surprise attack on Christmas Day against a Hessian outpost at Trenton and won a great surprise victory. No Americans killed in the battle. Very few were injured. A lot of Hessians were killed and many more were taken prisoner. And then Howe sent Cornwallis to deal with Washington, and Washington held him off and then gave him the slip and marched up to Princeton and won a second major victory. So that's where we left off with the Washington Howe battle. Howe has been in New York City during the early winter of 1777, and Washington was in camp. So that's where we are now. What we're going to do in this episode and the next is we're going to take a sidetrack. We're going to not look at any major battles, although we'll talk about a few significant battles. They don't count as our 10 key battles, but if y'all have listened to our series thus far and our Civil War series, you know that Scott and I are always sneaking in extra battles when we can.
Oh, yeah. We stuff this like a pinata.
Yeah. You know, 10 is such an arbitrary number. Why not just sneak in a few more? But these are significant battles that occur in Pennsylvania and many of them around Philadelphia. Significant actions. We're also going to look at the famous and very difficult and trying winter at Valley Forge. So we've got a lot coming up for you. I think you're going to really enjoy this. All right. So back to General Howe. General Howe, as I mentioned, spent the winter of 76-77 in New York City. Howe was not the kind of person that wanted to be out in a tent in the middle of winter. He loved, as we've mentioned before, Howe loved wine, women, and song. He loved the social scene in New York City. He had a mistress and didn't really want to have to leave her behind. So he stayed there and enjoyed the good hospitality of the good people of New York City while Washington and the Continental Army are out freezing their tails off. By the first week of March 1777, General Washington became convinced that Howe was going to move his army to Philadelphia. He'd gotten reports. Washington was always sending spies out, and he hasn't built his famous Culper network yet, but that will be coming fairly soon. But nevertheless, he has people working for him. He's got ears everywhere, and he realizes that Howe is going to move to Philadelphia. Now, why Philadelphia? Philadelphia was the rebel capital. It was where the Continental Congress sat. And Howe was a British general. He was a European, and in Europe, the general rule is when you capture the capital of the enemy nation or army, they have to surrender. That's the end of the war. Capture the capital, win the war. We'll see how that works out. But anyway, so this is March 1777, as I mentioned. But Howe was not a hard-charging, go-getter, you know, Napoleon, Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee kind of general. He was much more cautious and plotting. He did nothing in March, April, May, or even early June. He finally began to move the army in mid-June, and he was hoping to draw Washington out of his fortified position, his winter camp slash fortified position, into open battle. Being out in the open, just army versus army with no fortifications, no trees, no anything, just army against army, that would have definitely favored the British. And Washington knew that. Washington would have loved to have gone out and fought him in the open ground, but he was too smart to do that. He realized that's not the way to go. So he didn't take the bait. In July, Howe's army began to move, and on July 23rd, they set to sea. But it was not clear exactly where they were going. Where are they going to go? Are they going to go north? Are they going to link up with Burgoyne? Remember, this is what we're talking about now is actually before, chronologically, it's before Saratoga.
Burgoyne's got this. He can handle it on his own. I trust him.
That's right. Yes. July 30th, the British fleet was sighted off Delaware Bay, and this made it obvious that Howe's target was Philadelphia. As Scott mentioned earlier, Howe, partly due to a communication breakdown, partly because he had his own idea of what needed to be done, he was not going to go north to New York and link up with Burgoyne, much to Burgoyne's distress. Finally, on August 25th, Howe disembarked a light infantry unit at the mouth of the Elk River, and this is just 30 miles south of Philadelphia. It took Howe about a week to offload all of his troops and supplies, and altogether he had about 15,000 soldiers. And that's a pretty good-sized army for the Revolutionary War. Civil War, that's nothing, but this is the Revolutionary War, which is fought on a much smaller scale. The army, you will not be surprised to hear, moved very slowly. They reached toward Philadelphia. They reached the Brandywine River, which was half the distance to Philadelphia, on September 11th. There they met Washington and 10,000 Continental troops. Washington's army had marched very quickly from New Jersey. Washington did not want to let the Redcoats just march into Philadelphia without a fight. Congress had already fled, by the way. Congress is going to move several times during the war. But Washington felt like he needed to at least try to stop Howe and give him a fight. So that's the background to the first battle that we're going to talk about. Not a key battle in our numbering system, but nevertheless important.
This is a big advantage that the Americans have, that they're not defeated if their capital is taken in the grand European tradition, which helps if your government is only about 7 or 8 months old. They're not very entrenched. And is our capital Philadelphia? It's nice. Do we have to go to Appalachia? Well, you know, if needs be. So that's what they have going on. But this first encounter between the two armies is interesting because Washington and his staff almost missed the army. They didn't perform much scouting, and they thought that Howe would strike Wilmington and didn't inform themselves about the available road net or about where the fords were on the Brandywine Creek. So even at this time, the intelligence gathering isn't as good as it will be. So you're saying Howe is doing, he's moving against Philadelphia from the upper reaches of the Chesapeake to avoid defenses the Americans have constructed along the Delaware River. So this is probably Howe's only strategic mistake during his time in command in America, other than being way too cautious, like what James was talking about, that if he had landed at Newcastle on the Delaware, it could have saved him up to 25 miles overland, and he might have arrived at the city up to a month earlier. But just a little thing to point out, but let's move to the crux of the battle. So the armies are ready to encounter, they're ready to clash. What's going to happen?
Okay, on the way to meet Howe's army, Washington's army marched through Philadelphia, and there they were joined by a young man that we're going to be talking about a lot during this series, the Marquis de Lafayette. And I'm resisting the temptation to go into the Lafayette rap from the Hamilton musical. If you want, listener, if you haven't heard it, go to YouTube and search for Hamilton musical Lafayette. Guns and Ships is the name of the song, actually. But anyway, Lafayette was a 19-year-old French nobleman, and I imagine when Washington first was told, hey, there's a French nobleman here to meet you, he probably said, oh, great, another one, because there were a lot of nobles from different countries in Europe that came over, and most of them had one thing in common. They wanted glory, they wanted pay, they wanted a high rank in the army, they wanted to be deferred to. A lot of these Europeans came over hoping to teach the Americans a thing or two about soldiering.
Yeah, these European layabouts. I am a noble Prussian man, fourth in my family. I don't know anything, but I am from a noble line. Give me rank of general.
Exactly. Yeah. Just because I'm rich. But this guy's different. Lafayette actually offered to serve without pay. Again, I imagine to Washington, that was a big plus.
Yes.
Considering how they never had any money.
You're hired.
Yes. And you did say you're not going to need to be paid, right? And he was humble too. Lafayette actually told Washington one time, "I did not come here to teach. I came here to learn." And I'm sure Washington breathed a sigh of relief and said, "Finally, I get somebody who gets it." And he and Washington are going to develop a very close relationship. Many historians have categorized it as a father-son relationship. Washington didn't have any children of his own. He just had two stepchildren, one of whom died very young, and the other's going to die toward the end of the war, pretty young as well. So, anyway, very warm, close working relationship, very affectionate. I don't want to get too psychological with it, but Lafayette is going to be a huge help to Washington in many ways. All right. He does get a rank of general, by the way. Washington reached the Brandywine on September 9th, and he spread his army out on high ground behind the river on either side of the main road that crossed the river. So let's do a mental map, Scott. I'm looking at an actual map. And again, listener, as we always encourage you, get a real map if you can. There's a really good one that's put out by the U.S. Military Academy, if you can find that one. But the Brandywine Creek is, at least in this part where the battle is going to occur, is roughly north-south. It's really more, I would characterize it as northwest-southeast. But so think of your map. Think of this river going northwest to southeast, almost north-south. And think of Washington's army on the right side or the east side, and the British are on the other side, which is the left side. All right, so toward the bottom of your mental map, there's a brigade of Hessians stationed, and they attacked right across the river bridge. Two others under Howe and Cornwallis actually went north, or up on your map. They crossed the river, and they got behind the Americans, and then they came down. Washington made a huge mistake. He left his right flank unanchored. We've talked some about Washington's ability as a general. He really wasn't just a fantastic tactician. He wasn't really good with the X's and O's like other generals are. His talents lay in other areas, like just keeping the army alive was a major task.
Yeah, we'll see that later. That is a not to be undervalued skill with the army that he has.
Definitely not. And the thing about Washington, not to get too far off the track of the battle, but he was willing to listen. He would listen to his subordinates, and he would take their advice, but sometimes he would stick with his own guns. He was flexible and humble, willing to listen, willing to learn. And he did. He learned a lot and grew a lot as a commander over the war. But again, here he makes a mistake, a tactical mistake. His right flank is unanchored, and that is in the middle of your mental map along the creek. He wasn't expecting the British to come around behind him, to go way out of the way, way north, and then come down and hit him from behind. So this is going to be a major problem. This is going to be a very costly mistake. To their credit, the Americans did fight well. The lines held a long time, but eventually they collapsed. Darkness and exhaustion prevented the British from following up. That is a theme we've seen again and again, both in this series and especially in our Civil War series. You can't just march an army forever. Eventually they do have to stop and rest. And sometimes winning is as tiring, if not more tiring, than losing. But in this battle, the British lost 89 killed and 400 wounded, so almost 500 total casualties. The Americans lost 200 dead. That's major. That's a big problem. That's more than twice the British. 40 prisoners and 800 wounded. So we're talking about 640 casualties. So in terms of casualties, it wasn't super lopsided. The Americans lost about 100, 150 more, but they got pushed back. They were surprised. And then Howe does what he does best. He stopped.
Why seize the momentum? Just let it die. Peter out.
Yeah, I keep thinking about George McClellan, dear beloved McClellan.
Yeah, I thought McClellan, I thought of that when we started, that he must have read a lot of military manuals written by Howe on, when you have a great victory, make sure to rest for about 3 weeks between each time.
Be sure you don't pursue the enemy. Let him get away. Anyway, give him plenty of time to escape. It would not be sporting otherwise. Anyway, Howe stopped for 2 days. He did very little. Washington fell back to a new position behind the Schuylkill River. He was still attempting to shield Philadelphia from Howe's army. He's trying to stay between Howe and Philadelphia. And he got 3,100 reinforcements, which is always nice. Usually Washington has the opposite problem, doesn't he, Scott?
Yes.
Negative reinforcements, people going away. But this time people came to him and joined him. On the 15th, he recrossed the Schuylkill, wanting to attack again, but a thunderstorm prevented an attack. And that's another theme that we keep seeing again and again. Mother Nature, or God, if you will, or somebody, something, or just maybe it's purely meteorological. I don't know. But the weather is always jumping in and causing problems. Sometimes it helps the Americans, and sometimes it hurts the Americans. But Washington is going to send a messenger to Philadelphia to warn the Congress to evacuate the city. I misspoke earlier. I said they had already left, but they had not. Now they're going to hightail it out of there. They're going to get moving. So John Adams and all the Congress people are going to skedaddle to York, Pennsylvania. Oh, and the name of the person he sent to warn the Congress, it was Alexander Hamilton. His name is that? Okay, I won't sing the whole thing. But anyway, Hamilton is on Washington's staff by this time and is going to do a lot of his writing for him, a lot of writing orders and letters and things like that. And in this case, he's going to actually be his errand boy. All right, so that's it. So again, the Americans fought well, but due to Washington's mistake of not protecting his flank, not anticipating that the British would go way out of the way and come in behind him, the Americans have a major defeat. And I say major, significant. It's not like they threw all their things away and ran away and screaming and running for their lives. They did a nice organized retreat. But nevertheless, they do get pushed back, and it is an American loss. And it's not looking good for Philadelphia.
All right, well, yeah, let's just jump right into the next stage. How does Washington try to hold back this advance?
Okay, so the battle was on the 11th, and Washington, again, was going to try to resume battle on the 15th, but it didn't work. Now we come to September 19th. Washington ordered a general named Anthony Wayne to march around Howe's left flank. Trying one of those flanking movements again, Scott.
Oh, yeah. This is the age of flanking.
Yeah, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. This general, by the way, Anthony Wayne, later gets the nickname of Mad Anthony Wayne. He's going to continue to serve in the Continental Army even after the Revolutionary War, and he'll have a major victory in a battle with Native Americans in the 1790s. But that's for another series, maybe. Somebody else can do that. The next day, Howe sent a number of troops to meet Anthony Wayne's force. They overwhelmed Wayne's troops. They used only bayonets. The British like to do that from time to time. You know, it's variety, right?
Right.
Why bother? Why waste the ammo?
Yeah, save ammo, psychological warfare, does a lot of things.
Yeah, bayonets are really scary when you got somebody charging at you. And those things can be sharp. And 53 of Wayne's men were stabbed or hacked to death. The British just went nuts here. So occasionally the British don't act like the gentleman that they claim to be. Over 200 more were wounded. And this is later called the Paoli Massacre. So, yeah, 53 men, is that a massacre? I don't know about a massacre, but it's a really ugly thing that the British do. And it sure doesn't help their cause when the average American farmer and the average American townsman finds out about that. The British just keep, you know, they're trying on one hand to win the hearts and minds of the people, but then they do things like this, which really doesn't help their cause.
Yeah, it's like a Vietnam situation we talked about before.
Yeah, it really is. You know, on the one hand, you do nice things. On the other hand, you go massacre a bunch of innocent civilians. So anyway, the British forces do finally reach Philadelphia on September 26th. But Howe spread his army over a wide area near Philadelphia. So a lot of the army is outside of the town, spread out wide. Washington realizes that. And Washington, as we've seen, can be very gutsy. At times, he likes to attack. He likes to go on the offensive. He doesn't like this defensive war. So he decides that he's going to hit the British outpost at Germantown, just outside of Philadelphia, and attack one piece of the British army, see if he can do some damage there. So this happens on October 4th, but it doesn't go well. The American forces get behind schedule, mainly due to a dense fog. Again, there's more weather. They can't see where they're going. It's kind of hard to march. Also, Howe was tipped off by a loyalist, and the Americans initially they have a little bit of success. They push the British back, but then they lose their momentum, And they realize that there's a group of British troops barricaded into a stone mansion near the Germantown Pike, the major road, if you will, of the area at that time. And one of the maxims of warfare is you don't leave a fortified position in your rear. So they've got all these British soldiers holed up in this stone mansion, and Washington decides they can't just march right past it and just wave to them, wave, okay, see you later, guys. We'd love to fight you, but we're busy and we got to get down to Germantown. Washington realizes we can't leave this fortified, even though it's just a house and who knows how many guys are in there. So he orders that the house be captured. And this is easier said than done. The American troops try to capture this stone mansion for several hours, hour after hour after hour. And it's very hard to, the British just won't give up. The Americans finally give up and continue down the pike towards Germantown, but that cost the Americans several hours of precious time. And by 10 o'clock, the British had rallied and pushed the Americans back. And that's the end of what we call the Battle of Germantown. So again, another American failure. Not a crushing defeat, not an overwhelming victory for the British, but nevertheless significant. Although the casualties numbers, I will say, are a little bit more lopsided than they were at Brandywine. The British had suffered 530 casualties and the Americans lost twice as many. So actually that is, I think I'm going to dial back what I said a minute ago. That is pretty crushing. The Americans lost in the neighborhood of 1,100. But again, despite losing, the Americans fought well and they retreated in good order. So the Continental Army is getting better. They're still nowhere near as good of a fighting force as the British regular army is, but they're improving.
This is something that is challenging for the British. I've read in many different places that it was a Pyrrhic victory. And it seems like that's what the case for a lot of British victories, because their fundamentals are never very strong throughout the entire war. Most of their soldiers, they might be Scotch-Irish, Highlanders, who aren't really fighting for the glory of the British Empire, don't have the identity as strong. Hessian mercenaries, they're, like we said, trying to deal a firm blow but not get civilians roped in. But when your supply lines are stretched too thin, you're going to start pillaging the country people around you. And the fundamentals of the Continental Army, I think, as a war goes on, continue to get stronger. And Washington's army still has good morale after the battle. A lot of combatants had seen the British and Hessians go down in rows for the first time, and they thought that the casualties of the enemy were far greater than they were, even if that wasn't the case. And they were emboldened because they're fighting toe-to-toe with the Redcoats. And they knew that British casualties couldn't be sustained. It's just simply not an easy matter of carting over more soldiers from across the ocean. Loyalists in the colonies, they're not going to take up arms unless the momentum of the war really shifts in the other direction hard. But again, Washington shows his shortcomings where he didn't really plot things out as well as he could. He may have trusted incompetent subordinates, and he was outflanked like he was at Long Island. But he kept the army together, so that might be the most important thing of all.
Exactly. That the morale, the Americans come out feeling pretty good against themselves. You know, it's kind of like if, let's say, what's a bad NFL team, Scott? I don't keep up with NFL much anymore.
The Cincinnati Bengals.
Or how about the Cleveland Browns, too? For all of our Ohio listeners, we apologize. Okay. But we'll say Cincinnati plays the New England Patriots and they only lose by one touchdown. Okay. They would feel really good about themselves, wouldn't they? Like, wow, we lost. Yeah, we lost, but we only lost by a little bit. So that's kind of the Americans are feeling. Then their morale gets raised even more because after the battle, Washington receives words about the American victory at Saratoga. And also, that's good news, and that lifts the spirits of both Washington and his army. But then he gets some bad news. He starts to hear rumors that people are wanting him replaced. And I think we touched on this before, Scott. There was a lot of opposition to Washington. We today, you know, Washington is this national hero. His portrait is in every building, every school. There's statues everywhere to Washington. There's things named after him. But at the time, there were a lot. He had a lot of enemies. People like Gates. We talked about Charles Lee. They thought they were better than him. They thought they deserved to be the head honcho in the army, not Washington. We'll talk more about that in the next episode. This is going to, spoiler alert, this is going to turn into a full-fledged conspiracy. But for now, it's Washington is starting to realize there's dissension in the ranks. By the way, so Howe sends a letter of resignation to London. He felt that he had been inadequately supported in that year's campaign. He didn't think he was being appreciated. And he just didn't think, he just wasn't the right man for the job. His heart wasn't in it anymore. His resignation would actually be accepted, but he would not find out until April of the next year. So that's, again, we've talked about the problem with communication. It's not like you send an email and then the next day you get it. Oh, yeah, okay, you're accepted. The letter has to go across the Atlantic, and the British didn't exactly hurry. So he's in a weird position. He's sitting in Philadelphia, and he's having a good time with the wine, women, and song, but he doesn't know if he's going to have a job for much longer. Anyway, what do you think, Scott?
Well, I'd like to give another example of my historical theory of the Revolutionary War, which I call the Gypsy Curse theory. And I think this theory is quickly going to find its way into peer-reviewed journals and be taught in universities.
Oh, I can't wait. Can I work it into my class?
Oh, yeah. We mentioned earlier that Washington keeps getting dumb luck over and over and over and over and over again. Weather intervenes. He's able to escape from New York. I can't remember which battle, where he's basically caught in a pincher and he manages to escape between two British forces. This is another example on the Brandywine River where, by gypsy curse, I mean that perhaps when he was a young surveyor in the woods, he saved the life of an old gypsy woman, and she cast a spell giving him incredible luck throughout the rest of his life. Here's what happens. So Washington was almost shot by the British, but was, again, spared by fate. So Washington was riding with only one escort when he ran right into the British army. British Major Patrick Ferguson saw him. He didn't know it was Washington. But what he could tell is that it was a rebel cavalryman in uniform, and he was just less than 100 yards away from him.
Yeah, and he was an officer, too.
Right, yeah.
He was a pretty high officer.
Well, okay, so that was the first one, but then he was followed by what he saw, a rebel officer in green or blue, noting with a remarkable large high cocked hat. And he noticed, this man in the high cocked hat, he's riding a very good bay horse. And Ferguson originally gave the order for three of his riflemen to creep forward and pick off the two officers. But then he thought, I don't really like the idea of this. It's not gentlemanly. And he rode forward with a breech-loaded rifle to take the rebels prisoner and shouted for them to stop. What he could tell the officer on the bay horse, he did stop, and then he looked at him, but then continued to ride away. And Ferguson thought it wasn't sporting to shoot him and what he called an unoffending individual in the back, and so he let him go. He did find out that it was Washington later, and his aide next to him was probably Casimir Pulaski, the Polish volunteer who's called the father of the American cavalry. So there you go, another stroke of dumb luck for Washington.
Patrick Ferguson's going to pop up again in our story later. He's going to be the very important figure in one of our key battles, so stay tuned. I bet he wishes he'd shot him.
Yes. Pretty big missed opportunity, my friend.
I'm really glad he didn't.
That would have, turned things around a little bit differently.
I guess they probably would have put Gates in command of the whole thing, and that would have been a disaster.
Yeah, someone out there, if you're into the genre of alternate history, this could be a good hook right there.
There you go, yeah.
So what happens next?
We're going to talk very briefly about a couple of forts that were near Philadelphia, Fort Mifflin and Fort Mercer. They were on Mud Island near Philadelphia, and these were the largest of the three, or two of the three largest forts in the area. Sorry about that. On October 23rd, Howe and his brother Richard, Richard Howe is the naval commander. Obviously, William Howe, General Howe, is the overall ground commander, the army commander. They led a combined naval and land force to attack the fort. However, two of the main British ships got stuck. An American fire ship set another one on fire. If anybody doesn't know what a fire ship is, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's just when you take a ship or a large boat and you set it completely on fire, and then you send it toward another ship hoping to set that ship on fire. Sometimes it worked, and it did in this case. Two British ships exploded. So not going well on the river. The land attack didn't go much better. A force of Hessians attacked Fort Mercer, but the Americans put up a good fight. And the Hessians lost about 150 men to only 30 Americans. On November 11th, the British battered Fort Mifflin into submission, and the Americans evacuated Fort Mercer. So, again, another example of the American losses, and yet they conducted themselves very well. Despite all the British victories, though, Howe was unable to capture Washington's army. So Howe just basically says, all right, never mind. He gives up. He goes back to Philadelphia, where he's going to have a very active social life during the winter, as he had in New York previously. He had about 37,000 mouths to feed in Philadelphia. And as Scott mentioned, they can't just go down to Walmart and order a bunch of food. They have to bring it across the ocean. So they find an easier way, and that is foraging. General Howe sent foraging parties into the nearby countryside nearly every other day. And again, foraging is just scrounging up food. It's also known as stealing or just taking it. Legalized, or not really even legalized, but it's theft by force. And again, this does not do wonders for the British cause. It's not good PR for the British Army. In Philadelphia, Howe lived a lavish lifestyle, as we've seen in New York. One officer wrote, Howe did not take Philadelphia. Philadelphia took Howe. So that's a good quote.
You know, Howe, to his credit, he's having a good time during this war. He's not completely terrible. He's not doing it well. He's sort of like a slightly smarter Warren G. Harding, if he were a British general in the Revolutionary War, who might not be very good at his job, but knows how to have a good time.
That's right. That's the most important thing when you're leading a war, right? Have a good time.
He does, you know, have about 4 or 5 month convalescence after the summer campaign.
Yeah, that whole thing about destroying the enemy's army, it's overrated.
Yeah, Sun Tzu, what does he know? He wrote a long time ago.
So yeah, Sun Tzu needed to have more fun.
So, like always, Howe goes to some very comfortable lodge in the arms of another mistress. Washington then probably goes and bivouacs in a cold forest. And now we come to the dark night of the soul of the American Revolution. So what is the next chapter for the Continental Army?
All right, now we come to the famous winter at Valley Forge. And it's interesting, Scott, I've read in multiple places that Valley Forge, that the winter was not actually the harshest winter during the Revolutionary War. There's going to be one a couple years later that's even worse. But nevertheless, it's bad enough. It's really tough. And Washington, while the British Army is sleeping in nice beds or at least warm tents in Philadelphia, the officers are having parties and balls and dinners and whatnot. No such social life for Washington and his army. So they have to put the army in winter camp, so they had to select a position or a location. And Washington wanted to stay close to Howe's army in case they try something funny, but he also wanted to protect the Congress, which is now in York, Pennsylvania, as we mentioned before. So he chose a site on the west side of the Schuylkill River. That was 25 miles northwest of Philadelphia, and it was called Valley Forge. Probably because there at one point had been a forge there, and it was more or less in a valley. I've read that might not have necessarily been true. But anyway, that's the name that stuck, Valley Forge. And it's almost every American school child knows about Valley Forge, at least. At least I hope they do. They need to. If not, have them listen to this podcast. The army began setting up camp on December 19th, 1777. So this is almost a year after the Battle of Trenton. They had to construct their own huts because the site had little natural cover. And Scott, you wanted to talk about the huts a little bit.
Yeah, Thomas Paine has a good description of this. He said that as soon as the troops arrived in Valley Forge, they set to work like a family of beavers and called their little makeshift camp a curious collection of buildings in the true rustic order. And it makes sense. I mean, they're in a net massive forest and they have plenty of lumber for logs or fires, at least. So what these wooden implements look like were 14 by 16 foot huts that would accommodate every 12 enlisted men, and then officers would have less crowded accommodations. So these were built, but they were leaky, they were poorly ventilated. It gave some cover from the cold, but they're kind of glorified survival shelters. So the first steady stream of men arrives in Valley Forge, but it's going to get rough, as we're going to look at in a second.
Yes, this is a definitely a time that tries men's souls. Okay, so in addition to the fact that it's extremely cold, they had to build their own huts to live in. Of course, these huts are going to be drafty. They're going to be, don't think of a really good quality log cabin like you see today sometimes. they're going to be really rustic, really rough. In addition to this, the Continental Army's commissary head and quartermaster general, in other words, the person in charge of getting food and other supplies, resigned, and it was hard to find anybody competent to replace them. Washington had a couple that really didn't do the job well. So as a result of that, and as a result of the fact that there's just no money, the Congress doesn't have power to raise taxes. They can ask, but they can't force anybody to send them any taxes. So the Army, throughout the winter, has to cope with a frequent lack of supplies. Washington constantly wrote to Congress asking for more supplies, some help, but he got very little relief. And the men's clothes are starting to wear away and deteriorate. Some men were nearly naked. Others had mismatched and inadequate clothing. So it's freezing cold, and they don't, not only do they not have proper winter gear, some of them don't have anything at all to wear. They're just lucky if they can wrap a blanket around themselves. And the food wasn't very good either. It wasn't very fulfilling, wasn't very sustaining. The men lived mainly on something called fire cake. And this is a thin bread made of flour and water that was baked over a campfire. You often heard the cry, "No meat, no meat." Just meat was almost non-existent. Now, what made this even more frustrating was something I'm actually going to quote. I almost never quote directly from a source, but there's a great book on the American Revolution called The Glorious Cause by Robert Middlecoff. And this is what Middlecoff has to say about food in the area. He says, pork, which had been purchased in New Jersey, remained there to spoil for lack of wagons. In Pennsylvania, private contractors shipped flour to New England, where prices were better, while Washington soldiers had short rations. And a number of farmers around Philadelphia preferred to sell to the British in the city, who had hard cash, than to accept Washington's promises of payment. Washington didn't have any money, let alone hard money. He could just say, well, we'll pay you later. And a lot of these farmers, they didn't want to give away their supplies for the promise of maybe you'll get paid later. So they're actually selling to the British. It's actually just extremely, extremely frustrating. It'd be one thing if there just was no food at all available anywhere in the area. But the fact that food is being sold in New England, other food is spoiling, other food is actually going to the British, was extremely, extremely demoralizing to Washington and his army. And as a result of this, Washington was forced to allow occasional foraging, and he did not want to do this. Washington realized that if he sent his troops into the countryside and went to farms and just basically commandeered animals and wheat and grain and things like that, that was going to make people go over toward the British, at least in their hearts and minds, as we've said. So Washington really didn't like foraging, but at certain points he didn't have any choice. It was either that or starve. By February, half of Washington's army was gone, and as many as 1,100 deserted to the British army. They figured, well, we'll take our chances, we'll run to the British lines, and at least we won't starve to death. Many of the ones who remained behind in Valley Forge were sick and unable to serve. Although there was plenty of grumbling, there was no mutiny, so that's a good thing. Here's another quotation. This is from John Lawrence. John Lawrence is also a character in the Hamilton musical. So maybe that's the new thing.
That's a new drinking game thing, the Hamilton.
We've had a hard time coming up with something, but yeah, so every time I mention the Hamilton musical, enjoy yourself, listener. John Lawrence was from South Carolina. He was an aide of Washington's. He was a friend of Hamilton's and Lafayette's. He was also the son of the president of the Continental Congress, who's basically the head of the government. John Lawrence wrote, "We have some as brave individuals among our officers as any who exist. The men in the ranks are the best crude materials for soldiers, I believe, in the world, for they possess a docility and patience which astonish foreigners. With a little more discipline, we should drive the haughty Briton to his ships. So we need food would be nice, clothing would be nice, but we also need discipline. We'll see how that gets addressed later. The supply situation improved when Nathanael Greene became quartermaster general in May of 1778. We've touched on Greene a little bit. Greene is going to have a big future in some future episodes. He's probably the Washington's best subordinate commander, Nathanael Greene is, but now he's going to be, he's going to have a desk job. He's going to be in charge of getting food and supplies, and he's actually going to do a good job. He's unlike his predecessors. Whatever Greene does, he does well. We've talked about how he was self-taught. He had no military experience, but he was just smart and competent. He knew how to get a job done, whatever the job was. All right, Scott has a story of Washington at Valley Forge.
I want to mention one thing first about John Lawrence, his father, president of the Continental Congress. I have a historical fact for you, dear listener. If you want to be obnoxious and annoying to people around you, this is the one to use.
Oh, yes, please do.
Washington was not the first president. Do you know what number he was, James?
Well, I don't subscribe to this counting system.
Right.
I don't think the president of the Congress counts, but I don't know. There were several presidents of the Continental Congress. I know you had John Hancock. You had Henry Lawrence. I can't even remember who the other ones are. But
right. Depending on how you count it, Washington was the ninth. If you roll up all the presidents of the Continental Congress and then president under the Articles of Confederation, which is, it's almost non-existent. It's basically a figurehead, person who rubber stamps things. That's why we don't know any of these people, because it wasn't an important position until the government is reformed. And then it does become an important position as part of the executive branch with Washington. So if you want to be annoying, if someone talks about Washington as the first president, you can say, well, actually, and stretch out that word actually as far as possible for full effect, he was the ninth. That's all I'm going to say for that. A very random bit of trivia there. But again, getting back to Valley Forge, there are legions of stories of perseverance here, the terrible challenges where there are many factors that kept the army from falling apart. It was the resilience of the soldiers. They probably got the bare minimum they needed, but many people come around to Washington as the linchpin that keeps the morale going. And if he would have, let's say, hypothetically stepped down, then I see it almost certainly that the entire army would have fallen apart. So there was a common toast among American troops was Washington or no army. And when one junior officer during Valley Forge pleaded with him for a furlough to see his fiance, and he claimed that she would die if he didn't go, Washington refused and responded, "Oh no, women do not die for such trifles." When the captain asked what he should do, Washington said, "Write to her to add another leaf to the book of sufferings." So not the most, you know, rousing, but he's very matter of fact, and he's right there in the valley with you, shivering just as badly. So he did demand more discipline training for his men, and we're going to see how they emerge from Valley Forge, but it is a forge in many ways. So it's very fitting that that is the name of the place that they were in during that part of the war.
Yep. I agree with you. All right. Well spoken.
Thank you. Okay. So what's next? Well, actually, I think, is this a good point to stop and then we can pick up this narrative of what's happening?
Yeah, we're going to leave them in Valley Forge here, and then next time we'll talk about some more things that went on with Washington in general, and then a very significant thing that helps the Continental Army while they're at Valley Forge, and then another battle that we're sneaking in that doesn't count as one of the 10 key battles. But again, no battle is insignificant, so you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, all right, well, we'll leave our Continental troops shivering in Valley Forge for a little while longer, and then we'll pick things back up in the next episode. See you there.